So good afternoon. We're on our second day, our second full day of our retreat on wisdom and compassion. And this afternoon's talk is today's theme is on mindfulness and emotions, and mindfulness and sensations. So this morning, Frank talked about mindfulness and emotions and how emotions are, in our language anyway, a summary statement of the experience of sensations, things that come up that we, through our life experience, through our personal, our learning history, we tend to have particular labels for. And we respond from those labels. Interesting to note, and I think as Frank alluded as well this morning, is that they're really, emotions are very culturally based. There are many cultures where there is no word for emotions. In Buddhist psychology, there's no reference to emotions. In fact, emotions are really more a mental formation. They're things that we generate as a reaction to experiences. But primarily we talk about, certainly in Buddhist psychology and in many other cultures, it's the experience of what we call anger, what we define as anger, joy, things like that, are really sensations-based. In our experience in the West, we tend to, and certainly in the years that we've been teaching, it's interesting to discover we have such a lousy vocabulary for sensations. You know, we've got the fundamentals, the rudimentary stuff, you know, hot, cold, tingly, and that's about it, you know, for the most part. And so we really have to learn how to define and how to listen to the body to know exactly what it is that is being transmitted from the experience and external stimulus, from the experience in the body, what's being transmitted to the mind, and what's being transmitted to the brain. So, you know, pain can have so many different sensations, and that's transmitted to the brain in a particular language. And almost all the mindfulness is really learning that language. It's learning how to listen to the body, and as you're discovering, you know, as you listen to the body, there's a whole lot of things that it's saying to you that you may not know how to interpret, because like most of us, we all fall out of practice in terms of using this language. I grew up in Montreal, I spoke French growing up, and I wouldn't even dare to try to do anything in French right now because I haven't practiced the language in a very long time. It's the same thing with sensations. But emotions play a particular role in our life. They play a particular role in that they really are a way that we define our life. The way that we define how our life, whether our life is what we want it to be, what we don't want it to be. And I'm 5 minutes into the talk and I'm not even on script yet. So, let me get back on script. I will not comment on the fact that Frank gave my talk this morning, so I am never again showing him my script. So, as I spent most of this afternoon both napping and rewriting. I was in our small group, and thank you so much for the small group opportunity. Both of us were reflecting on how much courage there is in the room and how amazing you are for just hanging in and sticking this out. I know this is hard. We both do. We know this is really hard. And we're not enjoying watching the struggle, but we also know the struggle will alleviate itself. We promise. It will get better. Or not. I don't know. We'll see. But I was looking for this, my emotion of being insecure, right, not being confident, feeling anxious, I guess is more correctly it. I tend to like to have sort of the greats and near greats with their quotes kind of handy so that I feel like I have some credibility. So I came across this quote a while back, and I went searching for it on. I cut and pasted into my talk, and then in revisioning our talk last night, I cut it out and forgot to paste it somewhere to save it. So the funny story of this, of course, I spent about an hour looking for it, and I knew it was on Facebook where I had seen it. I didn't want to open Facebook, but I did anyway, and I did the search on Facebook. Couldn't find it. I was just about to give up, and I tried a slightly different search term, and it turns out I had quoted it about 5 years ago. So Facebook holds all of my memories. I don't need to remember anything. So this quote is from Andrew Lenski, who is a brilliant, brilliant Dharma teacher. And I don't know if he calls himself a Dharma teacher. Anyway, he's a brilliant Buddhist scholar and teacher. And it's from his chapter in the Wisdom and Compassion book by Chris Gerber and Ron Siegel. And it really summarizes what I'm inadequately trying to say. The vehicle of our being moves under our intentional control. The vehicle of our being moves under our intentional control. It carves a path and leaves a trace which represents our actions. Repeated, these become habits. Habits differ in permanence as if drawn in air, water, sand, or stone. Wisdom is knowing what is required to erase what was drawn and draw new paths. I really love the way in which he highlights the trickiness of habits, right? They differ in permanence. In other words, they don't really always hang around. It kind of depends on how they're stored in memory. They can store it in a very ephemeral way, which could be sensations. They can be stored in a fluid way, which means very associated with other things. They can be stored in a way that under certain conditions you can actually access them. Or they can be cast in stone. And too often we tend to think of all of our habits as being cast in stone. So the mindfulness, this today's practice, mindfulness of emotions, which in the traditional canon doesn't exist, but we're going to put it in anyway because nobody ever comes to see me in therapy because they're struggling with sensations. They come to see me because they're struggling with emotions. So I think it's important to honor that. So the issue of emotions is a really crucial one because it infuses everything that we do. What I'd like to talk about in this time that we have is about this arc of mindfulness practice. Where does this mindfulness practice take us to? For me, it's a practice of moral development. It's a practice of becoming a better person. You know, when we're little, we have a level of moral development that's very, you know, fair and unfair, right? This is not fair. I don't like it. I don't like your rules, right? This is not what I want. If you said you were going to take me to the park, you're going to take me to the park. You know, it's very black and white. As we grow older, we become a little bit more flexible. What's interesting in some of the theories of moral development is that at some point, we either become rule-bound, in other words, or we become rule-averse. I do it because the rule says I should. And if I'm not going to follow the rule, then I make sure I'm not caught. So, you know, yes, I'm willing to drive over the speed limit, but I also make sure I'm not going to get caught. So if I'm entering a speed trap, I slow down. Right. I'm not following the rule of driving the speed limit because it's a good rule to follow. I'm driving it because when it's suitable to me, I can break it, and when it's not, then I'd make sure that I'm not caught. Right. As we go along and we become to higher levels of enlightenment, I think, we begin to recognize that rules have to follow a purpose that's geared to the well-being of the community. And that we have to find a way of living to these rules in a way that's useful and healthy for all of us. So sometimes it means challenging rules that are not healthy for us. And sometimes it means adhering to rules but in a way that's healthy for us. So I may follow a rule because I know intrinsically it's good for everyone, including myself, Or I may break a rule because I know, ethically, this is a gray area and I have to do things that most people would consider wrong, but I have a principle that has to be lived with differently. So very often, for example, in the military or police, with many of the members that we deal with, this issue, this last way of dealing with rules and morals is a challenge because they're often called on to make decisions that cause moral injury. And we have to see this not because these are bad people or these are people who are capable of bad things, but because they've had to make totally unreasonable choices at times. So for me, mindfulness is very much one of learning these gray areas about how we're going to live our life. Because when I don't live to my values, anybody, when we don't live up to our values, we can feel guilty, and we do. And guilt is the difference between my ideal self and my actual self. You know, this is who I want to be, and this is how I'm behaving. And that's guilt. Guilt is a very useful emotion to have. Because it kind of keeps me alert to where that range is that I want to function with it. Okay. And we're not talking about toxic guilt, which is that self-flagellation about, you know, I'm a, that's actually shame. Shame is, I am a bad person. Right. Guilt is, I did something that wasn't quite right. In other words, it didn't match my values. Very important difference. So when I don't live to my values, when there's this incongruence, I can feel guilty, I can feel angry, I can feel sad. It just depends on the context, right? It depends on how I've tended to respond in the past. These are the habits I've built up. And so these emotions that come up are a response set that I've practiced over my lifetime. Okay. The difficulty with emotions is that they tend to kind of blindside us at times. We're okay with being blindsided with things like happiness and joy and, you know, the great taste of ice cream and things like that. You know, we're okay with that. The ones, of course, that cause us trouble is when we're blindsided with things like grief, things like guilt, things like sorrow. Those are things that, you know, we would prefer, you know, sent us, you know, an email that said, you know, tomorrow at 3 o'clock I'm going to show up. Then we can be a little bit more prepared, right? Because when they blindside us like that, it feels like we don't have any control over our life. Right? As some of you have mentioned in the meeting this morning, that, you know, the stuff coming up and you don't quite know where it is or where it's coming from, or even, you know, perhaps a little more anxiety-provoking, the stuff not coming up that you were waiting for and it's not keeping the appointment with you. Right? So these are interesting things to note, that emotions have their own little life and their own little way of expressing themselves. Okay. Now, the difficulty is we tend to judge ourselves based on emotions. You know, if I'm, I remember I probably shouldn't tell you this, in my internship during my PhD, we would, we had a practicum and we'd all have to role play and this and that. And I remember walking out, a whole bunch of us were walking out and, thankfully, I don't remember who the supervisor was, and all I do remember is this very tall man standing over me. Notice, interesting, right? I don't remember details about this person. It's not that long ago. It's only, 30 years ago, right? So this person standing over me, and I remember the sensation of this huge, towering person over me, and in my memory, you know, he's pointing his finger at my face and saying, you would do so much better as a therapist if you stop being angry. I said in a very angry tone. And it's seared in my brain, and I've walked away with this idea of, oh, you're an angry person. You are angry. You embody anger, right? And, you know, I experience anger. I express anger. It's taken me many years to go, I am not anger, right? So it's interesting that, you know, it's that. And I think particularly anger for all of us, we feel really reflects poorly on us. None of us wants to be labeled as an angry person. Right? So, I mean, for me, to be called an angry person, I feel diminished. I feel there's something wrong with me. You know, I feel I should be put on an ice floe and, you know, pushed out into the Arctic Ocean, right? I mean, that's to the extent to which I feel the shame of being called an angry person. We tend to value positive emotions, generosity, kindness, happiness. We have a we had an intern that joined us a year ago, and for her internship, and I had to sit her down and say, "I need you to stop being so happy. It's driving me crazy." She's just a naturally wonderful, bubbly, happy person, and it didn't go well with me. Because we also have a different way of processing and receiving other people's emotions, right? So while I value happiness, there was a level of which to which it was really activating something in me, and I, you know, I have yet to figure out what it is, but it was just downright irritating. And so, you know, we have this very honest conversation, and it's now, you know, it's a huge joke between us, and it's really quite interesting to notice that we all have this capacity to tolerate other people's emotions. So not only do we have a valuing system of emotions, we also have a level of activation where we're in the presence of other people's emotions. In technical jargon, it's called matching and catching. When someone's activated in some way, positively or negatively, we can either match that. In other words, if they're angry, we become angry. If they're sad, we become sad. Or we catch it in the sense that we absorb it and we carry it away with us. And I'm sure you've had those experiences where, you know, you may have been sitting with a friend who was you know, depressed or anxious or, you know, in some way distressed. And you start to feel that way too. Those are the beginnings of empathy. Empathy is a physiological arousal that we feel when we're around people. Compassion, however, is something very different. Empathy burns us out. If we're constantly catching and matching people's emotions, we burn out. Compassion, however, is our capacity to be with distress and not get derailed by it. So two very, very different things. But if we've got this preferential state of mind where, you know, we like this, we don't like that, then we really have to examine what it is about emotions that has us wanting to push some emotions away and has us clinging to others. So Frank read Rumi this morning.
Badly.
No comment. That's okay, dear. I feel your pain.
Is it empathy, dear?
No. After 38 years of marriage, empathy is at a low boil. Compassion, however, is wonderful. I am happy to sit with his suffering any day of the week.
As long as you're not bothered with it.
So Rumi, I love this poem. Frank and I actually had a good laugh over his reading of it. But what we also laughed at is that we've been reading these poems every year, 4 or 5 times a year, for 15, 16 years, and we still don't know it by heart. So we've made a commitment to memorize all our poems as a winter project by the fireplace. So we'll be reciting these poems, and I'll be able to teach him some prosody in reading the poems. So Rumi, the guest house. This being human is a guest house. It's a guest house. Every morning a new arrival. Every morning. Can you imagine that? If you opened your door every morning and there was a joy, a depression, a meanness, some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. You just translate that into a physical reality. You know, every morning there's a knock on the door and I think, oh, here we go. Right? Some new awareness, right? And this is also, by the way, I don't know if anyone's warned you that once you start on this path of mindfulness, there really is every morning a new awareness, and you're going to be wishing for the days where you were really sort of blind and ignorant about this, you know, deeper meaning of life. So it's a busy guest house, right? With experiences arising every moment, joys and sorrows, pleasant and unpleasant experiences, neutral ones too. We never tend to count the neutral ones. So what do we do with this? It is overwhelming when you think about it, right? Every single morning. For some people, it's the same experience every morning. I think it's easy to feel worn down by it. And it's not unrealistic that we hope, if I just start meditating or just how I start learning how to be in the present moment, I can avoid all these feelings, right? I can just not feel them. Well, I wish I could say that's how it works, because this is really what people ask when they come to our information sessions, you know, will I stop feeling sad? Will I never feel depressed again? You know, I hear MBCT really works for not to make me feel depressed ever again. MBCT is a wonderful intervention. Will it keep you from ever getting depressed ever again? I don't think so. I don't know that we want that either, right? Because really that's a question of avoidance. How can I avoid all of these negatively valenced feelings, and how can I only feel the positive ones? And it's a real shock when people find out, well, you know, the present moment, I mean, they already know this, which we're only saying the obvious, right? The present moment is not always a pleasant moment. I want that tattooed somewhere, you know? The present moment is not necessarily a pleasant moment. Because we wouldn't learn if it was. But also, it's just not realistic. That's just not what happens. It's also because, as Frank said this morning, the emotion system is an interlock system. It's not an all-or-nothing it's an all-or-nothing switch. You know, it's not like a rheostat light where you can turn it down a little bit and you turn it up a little bit. You know, you can do that to a certain degree. But if I shut off my experiencing of what I think are unpleasant experiences, sensations, I'm really numbing out the whole system. And some people were talking this morning about burnout, and burnout is exactly that. It's, you know, your physiology basically burning out, being fried by the constant arising of experiences that are hard to process. There's no relief. In many cases with military members that we've seen and treated, while there's a significant presence of PTSD amongst first responders and military, it's also triggered more, you're more vulnerable if there's been a constant level of deployments with no time to recover in between. Okay. So emotions can be overwhelming in that sense, because there isn't a chance for the system to rest and then recharge and move forward again. But Rumi says, you know, welcome and entertain them all. Even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house clean of all its furniture, still treat each guest honorably. That's the one that always gets me. You know, I used to focus on welcome and entertain them all because, you know, we're teaching emotional resilience and emotional tolerance and distress tolerance. We go, you know, welcome and entertain them all. And this morning, last night I was reading this, and I thought, treat each guest honorably. Wait a minute. Whoa. Where is that in the contract? Right? But it ties into what we've been talking about in terms of the five skillful habits. How do I treat everything that arises in me honorably? Like a good friend. Like I care about these guests that keep showing up every morning. Yeah. That's a huge ask, right? I mean, how can I treat anger honorably when anger for me is very much associated with being a bad person? It's kind of like inviting someone in to my home, my physical home, who's constantly been critical of me. I'm not sure whether to serve them tea or pour it over their heads, right? I mean, how do I treat, you know, tendencies, or how do any of us treat tendencies to gossip to be mean-spirited, to be selfish, to withhold information because we know that the person has that information, we lose on this deal, right? How do we do that? Well, that's where mindful self-compassion comes into play, and the five skillful habits. So let me go through mindful self-compassion and its components. Right? So mindful self-compassion, Kristin Neff developed the measure scale, and between Kristin Neff and Chris Gurma, they developed the mindful self-compassion program. And it's a powerful program. So according to Kristin's definition, self-compassion is defined as mindfulness, common humanity, and self-kindness. So mindfulness teaches us how to be steady in the face. First of all, it teaches us to know we're having an experience. It also teaches us to be steady in the face of difficult situations. This morning I was talking to the group that I was sitting with, and I described mindfulness as training us to be steady like a flagpole. Most of us tend to be the flag. You know, every little thing that comes along, we're just kind of whipping around and flapping and running away, you know, and being derailed, really, off center. But mindfulness is the practice of being steady like the flagpole. Right? No matter what the capacity, no matter what the wind velocity was, we're grounded, we're solid. Right? Now, the trick is to not be so solid that we break. So self-compassion puts the flex in the flagpole. It allows it to bend a little bit and move a little bit so that it doesn't become a victim of the wind. You know? And if you think of the flag as being sort of victimized by the wind, being, you know, thrown all over the place, it certainly is, feels a lot better to be the flagpole and to be grounded. Right? So mindfulness with respect to emotions means that we're attentive to what's arising. With equanimity. Equanimity is that even-standard approach to everything without a preferential mind. Okay. Notice I know it's there. It doesn't mean I'm going to encourage it or enhance it, but I just know it's there. Right? Anger is present. Jealousy is present. Frustration is present. Now, everyone uses Jon Kabat-Zinn's definition of mindfulness, which is mindfulness is when I say, well, what's, you know, how do you define mindfulness? And everyone I know will quote it, right? Mindfulness is paying attention on purpose in the present moment, non-judgmentally. That's attention. The part of the definition that's always left out, which is very sad, is his actual quote is, mindfulness is the awareness that arises when we pay attention on purpose, moment by moment, non-judgmentally. It's the awareness that arises. That's the key. Otherwise, it's just attention. I can pay attention and still act in very nasty ways. I can pay attention and do really mean things. But I can pay attention and be aware, develop that awareness that arises about what's arising. Right. And that's really crucial. Because when we sit on the cushion, we're learning not just attention, we're also learning how to become aware of our reactivity to what's arising. Okay. So mindfulness is very complicated that way. It calls in a very deep personal experience. The second part of mindful self-compassion is common humanity. That's the realization that none of us are spared this experience of emotions. You know, we have all had experiences with anger, with sadness, with loss, with grief, with depression, with anxiety. Every one of us. The challenge is that we tend to believe that our emotional reaction is unique to us. In other words, we're looking at, oh, I must have failed because I became depressed at one time in my life and my symptom scale was over here or up there. Somehow I failed. Okay. Now, mindfulness and common humanity the antidotes to our suffering. Okay? They are necessary when we experience destructive emotions, emotions that are damaging to ourselves and to others. When we're overwhelmed by destructive emotions, we stop being mindful. We become distracted, we become self-absorbed. It hurts when we're depressed or anxious. So what do? I mean, as Frank pointed out this morning, you know, we're fundamentally animals just on two legs and not without a lot of fur to keep us warm, right? So when it hurts, we do exactly what any other animal does. We go to ground. We curl up. We hope we're not noticed. We lash out. Right? We do that because we're also highly verbal, you know, we have verbal ways of doing all of that. Right? Mostly, though, we hope it'll pass. The difference, as Frank pointed out beautifully this morning, you know, is the difference between our massive forebrain and most other mammals and vertebrates is that we have a sense of time. And, you know, we have a sense of when, how long is enough for us, right? Whereas most animals will simply wait it out because they don't have a sense of passing time. Right. So because there's no interpretation of, I've been depressed for so long. Or, you know, I've been anxious all my life. Right. So there's a crucial difference there. The reality is the emotion does go away. It arises, hangs around for a while, and it goes away. As it's about to go away, we get in there and we start manipulating it, and it arises again. And it hangs around. And because it's hanging around, we get anxious, so we get in there, we start to manipulate, and it arises again. Right? So we start escalating. If we had the capacity to simply sit back, and it's not that simple, to sit back and watch this arising, hanging around, we could also see it start to diminish. But we're not patient. Right? So mindfulness and common humanity are really the antidotes to being distracted, dispersed, not really, you know, focused on attending to what's really happening. And common humanity is very simple. It's that, well, part of it is that also with mindfulness, because we know it's got negative consequences, you know, I have to be on long-term disability, my marriage is in trouble, the kids are frustrated with me, because we see this large, as Frank said, this larger shame process in our community around us, we notice when it starts to diminish, but then we become really hyper-focused on making sure it never happens again. Because the consequences to us seem so, so huge. I don't want this to happen again. So mindfulness then becomes obsession with making sure this never happens again. And we, on what level we would hope that we wouldn't have to go through this again, whatever, anxiety, depression, or burnout. But at the same time, we start pulling the levers. And our entire life becomes one of, how do I avoid this ever happening again? So if I feel sad, all of a sudden I'm already depressed. I'm terrified I'm going to become depressed. Right? If I feel my heart racing, I'm terrified I'm going to have another anxiety attack. So now it's no longer the original struggle that I'm having, but now it's an escalated one of trying to avoid something from happening, which we can't really. We can be skillful about managing it, but if it's going to happen again, it will happen again. The other thing we do, as I pointed out today, is that we start digging to make sure those symptoms really are not going to blossom again. So I gave the example of having a garden and going out every morning and digging up the seed to find out whether or not it had sprouted. I really did do this. Because, you know, this squash patch just wasn't proliferating. I mean, there was nothing growing. So I'd go out every morning and I kind of dig in there to see, like, you know, is there a root coming out? Is there a sprout? And I'd hold it and go, damn thing's still not sprouting. I'd stick it back in the ground. And I'm sorry to say, it took me a couple of days to figure out what I was doing. But that's what we do. We go looking for our symptoms. We start digging for our symptoms, which only activates them. Unlike the squash seeds, you know, it does activate them. common humanity, because when we're suffering, when we're going through so much pain, common humanity is really important, because when we're going through so much pain, we self-isolate. We're afraid to be around people because we're afraid they'll see us for who we think we are, right? I don't want people to see me as broken if I see me as broken. I don't want people to know that, you know, I have had or have in the moment suicidal thoughts. I don't want people to get close because it's painful to have people come up close. Right. So we become hyper-focused on protecting ourselves. But then, of course, you know, we get totally fused with our internal thinking and our internal process, that we actually start to become very fearful that that's who we are. You know, I have these thoughts about how hopeless I am and how, you know, impossible I am to be around, and that becomes myself, it becomes my identity. I start believing that my thoughts are reality. And of course, if I'm terrified that people are going to see right through me every time someone looks at me, I'm immediately going to, it's safer to interpret that they do see me as this person I think I am. Because then I can act on that. It's unthinkable that someone may look at me and just be looking around me, through me, or wanting to invite me out for a cup of coffee or something like that. Right. So mindfulness and common humanity are the antidotes to the way in which we react to our interpretation of ourselves as being this, you know, irrational, emotionally driven person who's probably, you know, too toxic to be around everybody else. So the solution is not just to then become mindful with equanimity to recognize that we're part of a larger community that is no different from us, right? It's also to act towards ourselves with a level of self-kindness that initially may be very painful. The thing with treating ourselves with kindness is that it also highlights all the times when we haven't felt treated with kindness. It's an alien concept, and it hurts. If no one's actually helped me with something that's hurt, that was a pain, a hurt, when I experienced pain, then the first time someone touches that area and says, here, this is how we can help you, just touching that area can feel like a burn. Right. You know, it's like resetting a bone that's never been set correctly. Right. And it brings up a history of never having been felt like you were treated with kindness. So it helps then to use the five skillful habits as a framework for our self-kindness. So, you know, we bring mindfulness to our situation, we become aware of the situation, we open up to the possibility that maybe we're not alone in this, you know, that everyone else has gone through this, that maybe there's a usefulness to what we're going through. And we'll get to the usefulness of anxiety and depression. They're very handy emotions. They are, really, trust me. We'll find out in a couple of days. See, notice how even just the thought that it might be useful, right? We just push it away. Yeah, no, don't want that guest showing up again. Right. So with the five skillful habits, you know, how can we be attentive to the impact of these, you know, destructive emotions? Can we see them as an alert? You know, they're like a distant early warning that says, hey, you know, you need to start taking care of yourself. It's easier for us to take care of ourselves when we're at the top of that downward spiral, of what one of my clients calls the, you know, the doomsday spiral. You know, he starts with sadness, and the next thing you know, it's all doom and gloom, and then at the very bottom, you know, he's curled up in a little ball, you know, feeling like he's not worth anything. So now we have a short form for what the process is. It's called the doomsday spiral. That's his language. So can we spot it at the top of the spiral? Will we have a little, again, we talked about a rumble strip, you've got a bit of a chance to kind of back up. I just had a flashback to driving down the wrong side of the road one day while I was talking to Frank, and Frank kept saying, aren't we going to the grocery store? And I said, yes. And he said, well, where are you, which way are you going? And I said, to the grocery store. You know, it's down over there. And then he yelled as a car was coming towards me. He yelled, you're on the wrong side of the road. I won't yell because of the microphone. And I thought, well, you could have just said that. Like, do we have to go through this whole thing? But, you know, it's easier to back up. It would have been easier to back up had I been further back than where I was when I was told I was on the wrong side of the road. But that's okay. I'm just having an emotional moment here. It's too expensive to divorce him. Can we be generous with our emotions? You know, can we have them visit and sit down with a cup of tea? There's this wonderful story told about Milarepa, the Tibetan yogi, and he goes up, you know, as Tibetan practitioners tend to do, they go off and seal themselves up in a cave for 3 months, 3 years, 3 years, 3 months, and 3 days, and they're fed through a little hole that people bring them food, and, you know, and they have a little box that they sit in, and there's nothing else in the room, that's all they have. Freaks me out even to think about it. So Milarepa goes up to this cave up in the Himalaya Mountains somewhere, and you know, he's in this cave, and of course he's working, and I guess this must have been the older days with less rules, but his cave had an opening so he could walk out, and so, you know, he's working on things, and all of a sudden this horde of demons come to visit him, and they're pulling on his hair, and they're poking his eyes, and they're, you know, doing all kinds of things. They're really pretty well tormenting him, right? And he doesn't know what to do, and so he sits and he meditates, and they're pulling on his whiskers, and they're ticking off his clothes, and he's getting really frustrated. So he gets so frustrated, he breaks a rule, he goes down to see his teacher. And he says, now what do I do? And the teacher says, well, you know, you have to go back up and figure out a skillful way to be with these demons. And he goes, oh, okay, I can do that. Goes back up, gets in this cave, and the demons come in, he drives them all out, puts a rock in front of the cave. And so, you know, the demons are like, oh, what? A challenge, this is awesome, let's do this. But of course the cave, because there's fire in it, has a little chimney, so the demons go in there and they stop up the chimney so all the smoke stays inside, and, you know, they throw rocks down the chimney. So you get the picture. I mean, these demons are just having a good time with him. So he tries to block this and they come here, he tries to do this and they go there. And finally he just gives up. He rolls the cave open, gets the smoke out of the cave, and he sits down. He says, fine, I'm just going to sit here. And the demons come in. And they're kind of curious, right? They're like, okay, what's going on now? What's he going to throw at us now? And he's brewing a pot of tea. And so he says, fine, Ryan, come on in, sit down. I'm too exhausted to fight with you guys. So he goes, oh, do you want a cup of tea? And oh, yeah, sure, we'd love a cup of tea. So, you know, 25 million of them sit down. He pours them all a cup of tea. And they have a chat, and the demons tell him about how tough it is to be a demon. You know, nobody invites them in for a cup of tea. And he kind of goes, well, they give you biscuits, but, you know, I'm on a 3-year, 3-month, 3-day, and I'm not supposed to give you, I'm not supposed to have biscuits. And you're really interrupting my enlightenment path here, guys. You know, can we get on with this? Like, what's the deal we can craft here? And they're just going to go, oh, chill out, it's okay. This is all in Tibetan. Chill out, it's okay, you know, we're fine. So they have this tea, and all the demons, you know, the little ones start to leave, and the medium ones start to leave, because it's boring just sitting around having a cup of tea. And the head demon is still there, and so he finishes his tea, and he looks at Milarepa, and he says, thanks so much for this. You know, no one's actually ever been welcoming of us, and this has been a new experience. I'm going to have to go process this. Got to go see my shrink, go process this, you know? And so he leaves, and Milarepa says, great, thanks, you know, come back anytime. And the demon turns around and goes, oh, don't worry, we will. Right? So, I mean, this is, I can't run retreats with this animal. I meant the dog, this animal around. Don't you just love him? Oh. Like, he's just so amazing. Anyway, back to topic. Am I allowed to play with you? Fine. fine. He's adorable. For those listening to the recording, we're talking about Thor. So how can we be generous with our emotions? How can we invite them in? How can we ask them to hang around and have tea with us and instruct us? Tell us why they're here. You know, tell us what their intention is. You know, can we treat them with compassion? Because they are trying to tell us something, right? My anxiety, there I go selfing again. Anxiety is a way of saying, be careful. Something's happening that you're not happy with, that you don't feel safe with. Pay attention. Depression says, enough already. You've been pushing and pushing and pushing. Lie down. Sit down. Please.
Yeah.
Grief says, this is a huge, huge emptiness in my life. Something's gone that will never come back. And I know, you know, impermanence. I know, I get it. You know. But it's still a huge emptiness in my life. And I don't know how to walk around this big hole that's there. You know, it doesn't have to be, you know, a person that we've lost. It can also be a career, an identity. I believe I'm a really good therapist. There was a time when I couldn't even walk into my office because I couldn't stand the thought of having to sit and listen to one more story, check on one more homework page, you know, redirect one more client because we're well off track 10 minutes into the session. How do I live with my concept, myself, that is, you know, the good therapist, and the self that's impatient and tired and frustrated, right? You know, that's burned out and can't hear one more story. Right? The solution to that, of course, is to become a mindfulness teacher. No. So, I mean, how do I treat all of that, you know, all of these things with compassion? I remember a teacher of mine saying, telling me that someone had told him this, and I took it on for myself as well. And the gist of it was, you have the right to be angry. You can fill in the blank for any other emotion. You have the right to be depressed. You have the right to be sad. You have the right to be anxious. But you do not have the right to not practice. It's a huge shift, isn't it? You have the right to have the feelings that you have, but you do not have the right to not practice. Because in the end, practice is the only thing that grounds us. It's the only thing that allows us to be in the presence of all of this, right? Because otherwise, mindful consumption, we're only consuming our emotions as a way of protecting ourselves. After a while, depression becomes such a good friend, such a great demon friend, that we don't really want it to leave because we understand it. We know what the conversation is going to be. It's predictable. The unpredictability that gave rise to depression is now substituted with the unpredictability of having depression go away. Even though we know it may never go away forever permanently, right? Anxiety is such a handy thing to have. I mean, it took me a long time to figure out that I was having panic attacks because it was such a handy thing. It got me out of going to dinner parties. Mm-hmm. Got me out of going out and meeting people or going for job interviews. I mean, I had a sugar daddy anyway, you know, I didn't really need to work.
There was a recording in anyway.
What was that? You're being recorded.
No. That's why I stopped.
That's mindfulness. Anxiety is so handy. But it's also so limiting, right? Because then I can only be that anxiety self. I can't be anything else. I can't entertain feeling that freedom to just go places and do things. Be myself, be who I want to be. Right? We can consume anger. Anger is so wonderful. I have to go back and tell this professor of mine, if I can ever just remember who the heck it was, what a gift he gave me. Because, of course, another professor said, took me aside one day, and she said, you know, Lynette, I don't know if you're ready for this. You know, and, of course, that's like them's fighting words, right? I don't know if you're ready for this, but you might want to learn. And I'm not sure you can, but you might want to learn how to say you're probably right. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine what the conversation was that brought that particular discussion up. And, of course, the worst thing you can do is to tell me that I may not be able to do something. Right? So I started to learn how to say you're probably right. And it's true, you know, you're probably right. You're also very hugely probably wrong, but that's okay. But it got me out of so many arguments, right? But anger, you know, anger for me was so protective because it kept me from hurting. Because it made me do a lot of things that hurt other people, but it kept me from hurting. But then after a while, we consume that anger. If anger is the only lens I have, then the only thing I see is threat. Right? Everything becomes a threat. And I pick up these hot coals and I go to throw it at somebody. Well, guess who gets burned as soon as I pick up the hot coal? Right? The other person's already seeing it because I'm signaling my intention. They're out of the way and I'm burned. So anger, while it can be very useful, it motivates social justice, it motivates protection, it motivates, you know, if someone's hurting my child or my husband, yeah, I'm going to get angry, I'm going to be protective. But it's not, it's like fossil fuels, it's a toxic source of energy. And when we turn it against ourselves, it's doubly toxic. But it feels righteous, and you know, I can consume anger for a very long time. I can keep going at it. So the five skillful habits are a way of being kind to ourselves. Can I be respectful of the impact of emotions on my mortality? You know, we know stress-related diseases are highly correlated with destructive emotions like anger. Can I be generous with my emotions? Can I allow them the space to show up, like Miller Raper? Can I sit down and have tea with them? Can I set limits? You know, initially it's really nice to kind of have a session where we're all complaining about something, but can I set limits on people for whom, or on relationships where these interactions are nothing but, you know, they're nothing but activating. Sadly, sometimes friends and colleagues who are depressed or anxious, we try too hard to be present all the time, and we burn out. Can I set, you know, healthy, kind limits around when and how to talk about that? Talk with them, to be around them. The definition of compassion is our capacity to be with someone suffering, not to be enmeshed in someone suffering. So can I be compassionate can I set compassionate limits? Can I refer to my emotions in a way that is self-compassionate? You know, can I speak to my emotions in a way that's kind, that's acknowledging? And mostly, can I just stop consuming these ideas of who I am because I'm an emotional person? I feel things deeply. You all do. Or you wouldn't be here, right? Can I be in the presence of who I am and allow that to be okay? The self-compassion and the five skillful habits are a really powerful combination because they allow us to navigate, you know, they're our compass, they allow us to navigate through all of these sticky situations that can be very challenging. Because it's so easy to get swept away. It's so easy to get swept away. So at the end of the poem, when Rumi says, you know, they come as a gift from beyond. They come as a message from beyond. They really are. That beyond is, you know, you can interpret it any way you like, but for me that beyond is something beyond anything I imagine possible. I never imagined depression as something that could be helpful for me. I never understood, you know, intense raging panic as something that could be helpful for me. But when I allow and I create that space, it becomes really, it becomes a creative partnership. So yes, we need. We're training, and we're in a 5-day mind training process. We're training to be aware. To be aware in every moment. The intention of that awareness is to cultivate, is a moral arc, is to cultivate a way of being that feels right for us, that is consistent with our values. And the truth is, we suffer when we're not consistent with our values, when we're unskillful. And I think that's the piece that's also missing in most formulations of mindfulness. You know, if we treat mindfulness as just a well-being thing, you know, it just seems to me an awful lot of effort to go through sitting meditation every single day, twice a day, just for well-being. You know, kind of figure like a trip to the spa would do it just as well. So I really feel like in order to go, to really have that transformation, we've got to go deeper. We've got to look at what's important to us. What are the values I'm trying to live to? And how does mindfulness make me more likely to live to those values? I would have finished on time if I hadn't gotten off script on the first sentence. So when we, do we have another, hang on, let me turn this off first.